Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're taking a really close look at, well, a pivotal moment. It's where digital assets stop being this niche tech thing and start becoming, you know, fundamental to global power. We're talking crypto, Wall Street, Washington policy shifts, and even big geopolitical deals.
Yeah, and our sources are showing this convergence, this integration. It's happening incredibly fast. We've pulled together quite a bit here. Market data from CNBC, some sharp analysis from former SEC counsel.
Okay.
Deep dives into political money from ABC News.
Yep.
And something pretty surprising on crypto security linked to a huge DOJ Bitcoin seizure.
So our mission here is really to figure out who's actually driving the crypto bus right now. And maybe more importantly, understand the new risks, regulatory, security risks that pop up when you mix billions of dollars with political power.
Exactly.
Let's start with the markets. What's the immediate vibe?
Okay, so right now, things look a bit sluggish out there. Major cryptos were in the red, struggling a bit. Seems partly tied to the U.S. government shutdown, which is now, what, day 10? Yeah, dragging on. And that absolutely creates friction. Washington stalls, markets get nervous.
Right.
Investors find it hard to price risk when, you know, the usual economic data isn't flowing. And we saw that reflected immediately in prices.
Yeah.
Bitcoin dipped nearly 2%, down to $119,000.
Yes.
Ether fell almost 5% to $4,100, and XRP was down over 2% around noon Eastern. That's serious cash reacting to government delays.
So the headlines look negative short term, but what's really interesting, I think, is this kind of split personality underneath it all. Institutions seem to be saying two completely different things about crypto.
That's the real tension, you're right.
Right.
On one side, you've got this massive institutional embrace narrative. Look at Morgan Stanley.
Yeah.
They just basically tore down the velvet rope around their crypto funds.
Yeah.
Used to be you needed, what, over $1.5 million, aggressive risk tolerance, taxable accounts only, very exclusive.
And now, what's the change?
Now, they're opening it right up.
Yeah.
Offering crypto funds to all their wealth clients. That includes retirement accounts.
Retirement accounts. Wow.
Yeah. That signals a huge shift, right? Moving crypto from maybe a speculative side bet towards something more like a portfolio staple.
Okay, but then you have the complete opposite signal, like Hargreaves Lansdowne, big UK investment platform.
Right, the counterpoint. They put out this really stern warning to clients against digital assets, stated flat out they do not see Bitcoin as an asset class.
Not an asset class at all.
No.
Or something that belongs in a portfolio for growth or income. Pretty blunt.
And that wasn't just out of the blue, was it?
No, no. It was a direct response to the UK lifting its ban on crypto exchange traded notes, ETNs.
Right, ETNs. So for listeners, those are basically ways for traditional investors to get Bitcoin exposure without actually holding the Bitcoin, correct? Like a tracker.
Exactly. It's a debt instrument tracking the asset.
Yeah.
So the very mechanism designed to bring traditional money in.
A major platform is saying, hold on, maybe don't use this.
Precisely. It shows just how deep the divide still runs in the traditional finance world. Really divided.
Okay, let's pivot to Washington, D.C., because this split seems mirrored there, too. I mean, for years, especially under the last administration with Gary Gensler at the SEC, the vibe was described as, well, openly hostile to crypto.
Mm-hmm. Hostile is a fair word.
So what happened? Why this, like, complete 180-degree turn in regulatory thinking?
Well, the change in administration brought in a totally different philosophy, a very pro-innovation stance at both the SEC and the CFTC. The new leadership, Paul Atkins, former SEC commissioner, was mentioned specifically they see these technologies as, quote, extremely interesting.
Interesting. Okay.
And the priority now seems to be on their potential for, again, quoting, dramatic improvement in how markets function. It's less about just risk and policing, more about enabling.
Wait, hang on. Innovation exemption? You mentioned Atkins said they might have one by year end.
That's what was reported. Yes.
Just focusing so much on speed and, you know, improvement risk kind of undermining the consumer protection side. That was Gensler's whole focus, wasn't it?
That is the absolute core debate right now. It's the central policy tension. But the momentum, right now, it's all pushing towards speed.
Okay.
Atkins floated that timeline. Yeah.
Yeah.
And beyond that, the two main regulators, SEC and CFTC, they just held this big roundtable, committed to working in lockstep.
Trying to end the turf wars.
Trying to end the perception of being two warring stepchildren, as they put it. And they're talking concrete changes, like speeding up approval processes, getting things moving faster.
So they're trying to get their act together internally. What about scope? Like, who regulates what, especially with new stuff coming online?
Well, the SEC's reach is definitely expanding with the tech. We're seeing more tokenized stocks, basically traditional shares represented on a blockchain.
Right.
The SEC is positioning itself to see those as new types of securities, or maybe security-based swaps, derivatives. Depends on the structure.
So they're claiming jurisdiction.
Pretty clearly. It's driven by this idea that tokenization is just more efficient. Mm. And you can expect the new leadership to issue more guidance soon to really cement the SEC's role there.
This regulatory speed up starts making a lot more sense when you look at the political angle. The sheer power digital assets seem to hold now. Let's talk about that political landscape because, I mean, the fundraising numbers are just huge. Sources said the crypto lobby was the biggest corporate donor in the 2024 elections.
The biggest, yeah. And the investor base itself is highly motivated politically. There was a recent poll showed something like 64% of crypto investors said a candidate's stance on digital assets was important for their vote.
64%, that's high.
Very high. And that same group overwhelmingly approved of President Trump and trusted Republicans more than Democrats on crypto policy.
And we saw Trump himself make a pretty dramatic shift, didn't we? Went from calling Bitcoin a scam.
Famously, yeah.
To actively promoting it, signed an executive order on a Bitcoin strategic reserve even. That came after meeting with the crypto lobby back in May 2024.
That meeting seems pivotal because right after that, just 7 weeks before the election, this platform launches. World Liberty Financial, WLF.
Okay.
Trump's listed as its chief crypto advocate. And the business model, I mean, the sources outlined it pretty starkly. 75% of the profit from their token sales went straight to the Trump family.
75%?
75.
And the total revenue numbers floating around are just staggering. What were the estimates?
Reports estimate WLS sold around $550 million worth of its token, which would have funneled an estimated $390 million in revenue to the Trump family.
Just, wow, $390 million.
From that one venture during the run-up to the election. And that kind of money, tied to a political figure, inevitably raises questions about access and influence.
Right. Like the Justin Sun case.
Exactly. Crypto billionaire Justin Sun. Sources confirmed he invested heavily in WLF, $75 million total. Now, critically, Sun was being prosecuted by the SEC under Gensler. That case was paused shortly after Trump took office. Now, critics immediately point to that sequence, big investment, followed by seemingly favorable regulatory treatment.
A potential pattern.
That's the allegation, yeah. And you see echoes of this focus on maybe transactional access, even in the meme coin world.
Oh, yeah, the Trump meme coin. That generated huge trading fees too, right?
$320 million in trading fees. But even for smaller players, the promise of access could be thin. There was that anecdote about the young investor Nick Pinto.
I saw that. Felt scammed.
Yeah, he went to a gala dinner, advertised as being with Trump, but Trump apparently gave a short speech, like 23 minutes, and left before the actual meal.
So less mingling, more just the transaction itself.
It felt that way to him, certainly. Seems the focus was often the financial exchange. And this nexus of business and policy, it doesn't stop at the U.S. border. It gets even more complex when foreign governments and huge sums of money are involved. We have to talk about that $2 billion deal with the UAE.
The United Arab Emirates. Okay, this sounds like high-level international finance meets government power. Lay out the key details for us.
So this involved the UAE's Government Sovereign Wealth Fund. It's called MGX, chaired by Sheikh Taknoon bin Zayed Al Nahyan. They agreed to put $2 billion into the Trump family's WLF platform.
$2 billion? How did that work?
They used a stablecoin, minted by WLF itself, apparently, then moved the funds to Binance and deal structure,
right.
Projected to generate over $80 million a year in interest.
Going to who?
To the Trump and Witkoff families, according to the reports.
Okay, the timing on this. That's what really jumps out at me, linking it to U.S. foreign policy.
The timing is, let's say, noteworthy. This huge investment gets announced in early May. Just 2 weeks later, President Trump travels to the UAE. And then the U.S. announces a major policy shift.
Which was?
Allowing the UAE to buy hundreds of thousands of advanced NVIDIA AI chips. This was tech that the previous Biden administration had kept under tight controls.
So, massive investment benefiting the president's family enterprise, followed very closely by a significant policy change benefiting the government whose fund made the investment.
Right. Now, our sources are careful. No explicit proof of a direct quid pro quo has emerged. But that sequence of events,
it raises serious questions, naturally.
It inevitably sparked huge controversy. Critics, including ethics lawyers cited in these reports, say this looks like the classic definition of corruption,
mm-hmm.
using public office for private gain.
Mm-hmm.
And it really shines a light on a key point. Presidents are actually exempt from the main federal law that stops other executive branch officials from having financial conflicts of interest.
That seems like a massive loophole.
It's a long-standing exception. The defense offered by former Trump advisors is essentially he's following the letter of the law, operating in a space where those specific conflict of interest laws just don't apply to the president.
But the scale here.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The counterargument is that the sheer scale, the intensity of mixing private business with high-stakes federal and international policy like this,
yeah,
it's just unprecedented. It's a whole different ballgame.
Okay, so when you have billions flowing between private interests, political power, foreign governments, maybe unchecked, the conversation has to shift from just what can the market do to what can the government take?
Precisely.
And that brings us to this really quite shocking security paradox, something that should probably worry every single crypto holder.
It really should. The backdrop is the DOJ announcing the largest forfeiture in U.S. history. They seized 127,000 Bitcoin.
127,000, valued at what, $15
billion? Around $15 billion, yeah. Tied to this alleged ringleader of a massive pig butchering scam network, mm-hmm. a guy named Chen Shi, also known as Vincent, and he's still at large.
Okay, so if the Bitcoin was on an exchange, seizing it is straightforward, right? Yeah. Subpoenas, warrants.
Standard procedure.
Right.
But the report explicitly states this huge stash was seized from unhosted wallets, self-custody wallets.
Right, the kind you control the keys for.
Exactly. And since the alleged owner, Chen Ji, isn't in custody, the DOJ hasn't said how they got the private keys.
So, how did they get them? If they weren't on an exchange, and they don't have the owner, this sounds like it undermines the whole point of self-custody, doesn't it?
It points directly at a critical, often invisible vulnerability. It's known as weak key generation.
Yeah.
Or sometimes predictable private keys.
Weak keys. What does that mean?
Well, the whole security model of crypto rests on the private key, that incredibly long, random string of numbers you need to move funds being truly random.
Yeah.
Impossible to guess.
Okay, but sometimes it isn't random.
Sometimes, yeah, it's not random enough. It can be a flaw in how the key was generated in the first place. Maybe poor programming in the wallet software, or not enough real randomness entropy from the hardware device that created it.
Like a quality control failure.
Essentially, yes. If the keys are weak, predictable patterns might exist. And with enough computing power, those patterns can potentially be found. The key can be reconstructed or guessed, bypassed.
So it's not that the core Bitcoin cryptography is broken.
No, not the underlying math.
It's a flaw in the specific tool, the software, or the hardware wallet that made the key.
Exactly. And this isn't purely theoretical. There's historical context.
Mm.
Remember that huge 2020 theft? Also 127,000 bitcoins from the Lubian mining pool back then?
Vaguely, yeah.
Well, speculation at the time, and looking back now, suggests that theft might also have stemmed from this same kind of single invisible flaw. Predictable private keys generated by their systems.
Okay, that is worrying.
It should be a major concern for anyone using hardware wallets or any form of cold storage for long-term self-custody.
Which brings it right back to you, the listener, doesn't it? If the device or software you use to generate your keys wasn't up to scratch, maybe had sloppy security, then your secure self-custody might not be so secure after all. It doesn't matter if you're some international scammer or just trying to save for retirement, the vulnerability could be the same.
It's a stark reminder. As digital assets move into these halls of power, everyone needs to step up their game. Understand the policy risks, yes, but also really nail the security fundamentals. Hashtag, tag, tag, outro, outro.
Wow. Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground today. Three huge currents, really. Wall Street kind of opening the floodgates, but still deeply unsure.
That cognitive dissonance, yeah.
Washington ripping up the old regulatory playbook, pushing for speed and innovation.
Mm-hmm.
And then these profound ethical questions and now security questions that arise when all that money meets political power.
It's clear the integration is accelerating.
Mm.
And that just demands more awareness from everyone involved. Awareness of the policy shifts, yes, but also critically, these foundational security issues.
So we know governments can seize huge amounts of Bitcoin, even from self-custody wallets, possibly by exploiting flaws in how keys are generated, which leaves a pretty pointed question for you to think about. Could the biggest threat to your carefully self-custodied funds not actually be some sophisticated hacker or a future regulation, but maybe just an unseen quality control issue? A failure in the very device or software you trusted to generate your original, supposedly random private key.
Something to definitely mull over.
We'll leave that thought right there with you. Thanks for joining us on The Deep Dive.